Is it possible to turn the house lights up a little? A little more? That doesn't affect it, does it? Because it's really difficult to talk at an AA meeting without seeing other alcoholics. And there's kind of a feeling of show business when you just have spotlights and dark crowds. And a lady said to me before I got up here, she said, and she's a lovely lady, and I know that she meant well. And she said, I've told everybody how good you are, so be real good tonight. And I understand that, but I also understand the danger. If this ever gets to be show business, we're in real trouble. And so I don't think good has anything to do with it. I'm just going to tell you about my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had prepared to give a glowing acknowledgement to the committee for the 40th Annual Florida State Convention. And I was going to get up here and tell you how wonderful it was. And then they read Ann Landers. Oh, God. I get to a lot of conferences all over North America, and conference committees would be well advised to come here and take a lesson to how to run an AA conference. It's been a really tough. It really is. I don't say that to be ingratiating. It really is. Everything's on time. There's no hocus pocus. There's no unnecessary stuff except for reading Ann Landers. Now, I'm going to forgive you for that, but not today. But it's an honor to be here, and it's a privilege, and it's my privilege. Now, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you've attended this conference, I know what must be going through your mind, and that is you've listened to very intelligent, very gifted orators, people who can communicators. Who were eloquent in being able to explain to you how they were and what happened to them and what they're like now. But the comfort level of the beginner and the comfort level of the speaker is diametrically opposed. And if I'm new to Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm listening to all these polished speakers, I have to say to myself, my God, I never could be able to do that. I'm never going to be able to get up in front of all those people, and I'm never going to be able to talk like that. I don't want you to be intimidated by the speakers that you hear at conferences such as this. You can be inspired by them, and that's perfectly okay. But I don't want you to be intimidated by them. And it was funny that Ernie reminded me of something that Clancy had told him and I knew about. And that was one day a person walked up to Clancy. I don't know if you know who he is, but nevertheless, there was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous named Clancy, and somebody walked up to him and said, Clancy, are we all just freaks? And he said, no, just those that we asked to talk. So don't measure Alcoholics Anonymous by speakers such as me. Alcoholics Anonymous is a diverse conglomeration of all kinds of people. We don't have jobs. We do have jobs. We live in average homes. We don't have a place to live. We live in the White House. We're a strange group of people. Some of us are well-educated, and some of us have no education at all. We've been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. We have played in the Super Bowl. We have given addresses as chairman of the most powerful committees in the United States Senate. We've lived in the White House, and we've walked on the moon. And we've slept in abandoned cars. And we've been ashamed, and we've been glorified. We are a conglomeration. There's no profile for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are, but we are bright, and we are talented, and we're cursed with sensitivity, some of us that are just unbelievable. Now, I understand that there are some people here who are new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And someone told me that there was some large number of people in this room. Now, I know that in the other rooms that will be true, and I can't look at them. But is there anybody here in this room that is less than 90 days sober in Alcoholics Anonymous? Anybody? Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Come here. Good. Good. Sir, what is your name? Hi, Joe. And ma'am, what is your name? Pam? Hi. If I keep doing what I'm told, and I keep showing up, and I keep praying, in the middle of November this year, people I sponsor in connection with my group, the Lamont Oaks group, are going to throw a surprise birthday for me. And what the purpose of that is to celebrate my conclusion of my 25th continuous year of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I'm through, you're going to know that if I could make it, you can make it. If you've been through this entire conference, you've heard over 100,000 words, maybe 200,000 words. And I'll venture to say that you can't remember 1% of them. I don't think you could remember half of 1%. If I gave you a pad and a pencil and I said, write down what you've heard at this convention, I would bet that you couldn't use 500 words. Don't hear and try to remember anything I said or I'm going to say. Listen to the music. Listen to the music when you attend functions like this. Listen to the music when you're new. It's the music of hope. If you're like me when you're new, my mind wasn't capable of grasping any great understandings. I couldn't pick up the nuances of these polished speakers, these sincere people who had wonderful experiences and they related them in a concise way. I couldn't understand it, but I heard the music, and the music said there are other people like me. And I never knew that. Until I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not know there were other people like me. It was a wonderful discovery. And yet, I know that there's a lot of new people that are in these other rooms, this amphitheater and the smoking room and so forth and so on, and I want to address each and every one of them through Joe and through Pam. I'm going to tell you a funny thing. I always, whenever I give a talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, in a function like this, I always talk to some newcomers. And a lady came up to me, and I don't remember who they are because I do so much of this. And a lady walked up to me yesterday. Her name was Vicki. I don't know if Vicki is here, but it's really not important. But Vicki walked up to me and says, "You don't remember me, but you gave a talk in Orlando, Florida. And it was 5 years ago yesterday or today. And I was the girl that you spoke to. And I haven't had a drink since then." And she said to me, she said, "Because after you talked, I was afraid to have another drink." I guess I dropped some of those threatening lines that I used to use to beginners, but I don't. We call them beginners where I come from. In my group, we have a meeting for beginners. We call it the beginners meeting. Some people call it sober school. I don't have any. I chair that meeting and have for a long time, and it has saved my life. It has given me great understandings in Alcoholics Anonymous, far greater than I could get myself, because I learned how to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I was a very smart guy when I got here. I was a very bright guy. I was a successful guy when I got here, except my life was in ruins. And I tried every way I knew how to straighten it out. I couldn't do it. But I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I learned how to learn. And I'm going to teach you tonight how to learn. And it's very simple. If you want to learn how to live sober and you want to have a structure in your life that will work for you in all events, first you have to listen and you have to be quiet. When you go to your meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're new, just be quiet and listen. And when you leave those meetings, remember what you heard. And after you remember, in your life, out there, practice what you learn. And the last element to learning is, in your practicing of it, teach it to someone else. Because it's in the teaching of Alcoholics Anonymous that we hear the sound of our own voice and come to understand that, yes, I really am a real alcoholic. And yes, I really know the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. It just works that way. You see, I know how it works because they read it at every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I also know why it works. This thing works because something special happens when one alcoholic speaks to another, and it doesn't happen that way in any other condition or circumstance. You may come here, Pam, and you may want to leave here, and you may not like us, and you may not like what we say, but you will never be able to leave here and say, they don't understand. So, no matter what you do, no matter how you conclude what your right to live your own life and how, if AA has a place in that, you're never going to be able to say, those people didn't know, they didn't know how I felt. Here's the bad news, Joe. Because there's good news and there's bad news. You know, it was hard to come here. It's hard to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. It is, Pam. It's hard. It's harder to stay here than it is to come here. Now, that's the truth. And where I come from, we tell the newcomers the truth so that to arm them with the ability to take on this thing called alcoholism. And we have some pretty good results by telling newcomers the truth. It really is that way. If you challenge me to write down all the things that I think were wrong about Alcoholics Anonymous or what I don't like about Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd have to get a legal pad. Because I could fill a legal pad with all the things that's wrong with Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter how much I write, I can balance everything that I write about my criticism of Alcoholics Anonymous if I look just to the other column, and all I need is a little scrap of paper, because all I have to write on that scrap of paper to balance off everything I don't like about Alcoholics Anonymous is simply this. AA works. And once you said that, you've said it all. And you don't have to say anything else. It's really true. Now, when I said it's hard to stay here, I don't know how I could give you a better understanding of that, but to tell you that when I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on November 3rd, 1971, I was the person in the world of Alcoholics Anonymous who had the least amount of time. I was sober 8 hours. Maybe sober. I don't know. But I hadn't had a drink for 8 hours from the time I passed out until the time I went to that meeting. So for all intents and purposes, everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous was sober longer than me. And when I walked in that room, they gave me a book. And inside that book that says there are a million people sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm not a fool. I could count. There's a million, and then there's me. Every few years, up until recently, General Services in New York publishes a survey of the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't do that anymore. My understanding, they're not going to do it anymore. Is that right? They are going to do it? I'm sure they are. I'm glad, because the last survey indicated that I was in the top 2 percentile, which means that 98% of all the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have less time than me. Isn't that sad? The sadness is that here I've moved from zero up 98 spots to the top 2. And I couldn't have done that if the people that were here when I came had stayed. Had they stayed, I could not have moved up. Now, don't you dare infer from what I'm saying that Alcoholics Anonymous does not work. Alcoholics Anonymous works just fine. And when they wrote and published in 1939 the observation that rarely have we seen a person fail, they were telling the truth. Who have thoroughly followed our path. And the cunning and the baffling and the mysterious thing about Alcoholics Anonymous and alcoholics is that we won't do it. This is the only disease recognized by any board or any doctors or any psychiatrist or anybody, that the people who suffer from it have no enthusiasm for recovery. And that's what's so baffling. And that's why people die in Alcoholics Anonymous every day. And as fast as they come through the front door, they go out the back door. And often we don't even know who they are. And that is not, has nothing to do with the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. It really doesn't. But I'm going to tell you that I have to do some kind of, two things we're going to have to do. Number one, we've been here a long time, and I understand, and I'm a realist. Anybody that needs to get up at any time to go out of that room, just feel free to do that, because I may do that. And Joe, you're sitting there and you have a watch on. I want you to raise your hand 50 minutes from now. You know why? Because if I do that, I will not fall into the trap of falling in love with the sound of my own voice. And these people have just so much that they can endure. Okay? So you do that. You raise your hand 50 minutes from now. I had a pill, Joe, that could make you a social drinker. Now, this is a guaranteed pill. This is a pill that I have researched, and it works perfectly. You take this pill, and you are a social drinker, and you continue to be a social drinker the rest of your life. What do you think, Joe? How's that sound? Where do I sign, he says. Thank you, Joe, because I needed that response to go on with the rest of this little silly story. Isn't that amazing, Joe, that guys like you and I have never really understood the meaning of the words that we use? I offered you a pill that would make you a social drinker, and you, without any hesitation, says, I'll take it. Joe, I don't think you take it. I really don't think you take it. Let's talk about it just for a minute, because maybe it'll help everybody that's in your shoes, new to Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe come to grips with these terminologies that we use. Social drinker. What do you know about social drinkers, Joe? Let me ask you, when the last time you thought you'd go out at night and you get to have some fun and you thought to yourself, let me see. Let me call one of my social drinking friends. And Joe, if you're like me, social drinkers are bored. They hold no interest whatsoever for me. Why would I want to go out with a social drinker? There's no excitement. Social drinkers go out and want to know where they're going. I don't want to know where I'm going. I have no idea where I'm going. They want to know when they're coming home. I don't know if I'm ever coming home. Joe, when social drinkers meet each other and they say, hey, let's have a drink. You know what they do? They stop, they have a drink, and then they go home. Would you like to live like Joe? Joe, social drinkers watch him at a bar, if you can get him at a bar. And watch the bartender puts a drink in front of him. Watch real close what they do. You know what they do, Joe? They talk. Now, I had that experience in dramatic technicolor form, trying to do a talk for Cecil in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. Now, Father, you know to get to Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, you have to take five different airplanes. And I was coming from Naples, Florida. And that's really an experience. Naples, Florida to Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. And in the last airplane we were on, it was such a rickety plane that the drinks were free. And on my left were two young men, and they ordered Molson Lager. Molson's a beer. And I'm a connoisseur of beer. And this person, I couldn't distinguish if it was male or female, that was the steward person, poured this ale in these two styrofoam cups. And I watched the head of that beer rise. It's beautiful. And they had little trays, you know, you have in the airplane. And I looked, and they talked. And I thought, no. And I looked away, and I looked out the window at the frozen tundra of Manitoba. And it was like 10 minutes, I guess. It seemed like 10 minutes. Maybe it was two. And I just... And the head was falling. And they hadn't picked up the drink. And I'm thinking, control yourself. And I look out the window. And I wait, and I turn around again, and the drinks are still there, and now the head is gone, the beer is flat, and I want to kill him. How'd you like to live like that one day at a time, Joe? Social drinkers, when they're asked to have the second or third drink, you know what they say? This is the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. No, thank you. It's not the punchline. Here's the punchline. No, thank you. I'm starting to feel it. I have a wife like that. It's unbelievable. I'm starting to feel it. I'm going to give you this explanation, Pam. It's not really, you don't have to be a rocket scientist, but I've learned this. Every person who takes alcohol in their system, alcohol has an effect upon them, alcoholic or non-alcoholic. It changes how they feel. It changes how they look at their environment. A change occurs. You see, when people, social drinkers, feel that change occur after the second or third or first drink and say no thank you, the reason they say that is because, Joe, they like how they feel. And they like how their environment looks to them. And they don't want to change that. And when the change starts to occur, they say, no thank you. I've had enough. Joe, I don't like who I am. I don't like where I am. I don't like the environment in which I find myself. And when the change starts to occur, I say more. And I will always do that as long as I live, because I'm an alcoholic. And Ernie said, for him that means I can't take a drink safely, and I agree 100%, but it also means something in addition to me. It means that I am the type of person who has trouble living sober and drunk. And sober has never been my answer, because every time I got sober, I would then get drunk. And I always got drunk from sober. So when you come and point out to me in Alcoholics Anonymous that I can have sobriety, I tell you that's not going to work for me, because sober doesn't work for me. There's got to be more here than just sober. And there is more here than just sober. And that's really the good news. I have to tell you a little bit about myself, only to qualify, because it's a nuisance that you have to do that. But I'm not going to talk a lot about drinking. We heard a lot about drinking, and we heard a lot of stories this weekend that any self-respecting alcoholic could relate to. But I'd like to do something that sometimes not done in AA meetings, and that is I'd like to talk about recovery. Sometimes we spend so much time talking about drinking, we don't get to the recovery, and they have left, and they never heard the recovery part. Joe, if you're an alcoholic, there's nothing you don't know about drinking. You know everything there is to know about drinking if you're an alcoholic. Pam, you think I could teach you anything about drinking? You know everything there is. Let me talk to you about how to live without having to drink to stand it. Wouldn't that be a novel kind of an experience for people like you and I? To show you how that worked in my life, I'll tell you a little bit about my life. One day I was told by a sponsor, you'll learn about that later, and it's not really a bad thing. It just seems to be bad. I had a sponsor who insisted that I take a fourth step. You'll hear about that too. Not from me, but you'll hear about a fourth step, and a fifth step. And I was forced to write a searching and fearless moral inventory. Moral inventory. Key word, moral inventory. And I'm going to start writing this, and I immediately start at the age of six. Isn't that funny? That's just my story. At the age of six, I was already into moral problems. How did it happen? I don't know. I had an identity. I don't know what my identity was when I was six. I could tell you when I was six, my dad told me what I was to do with the rest of my life. My dad was a factory worker, and he never had any money, and we didn't have a lot of things. We weren't poor. We just didn't have a lot of stuff. And my dad told me I was to be a lawyer, and I didn't know what a lawyer was. And nobody who's six knows what a lawyer is. And when you go out in the playground, and the kids talk about what they're going to do when they grow up. They want to be policemen and firemen and actors, and they want to be airline pilots and on, but nobody ever says I want to be a lawyer, because nobody at six knows what a lawyer is. In 1993, I retired after 32 years of the practice of law, and I had to get out of there because I couldn't figure out what the hell it was. All I knew is that I didn't fit, and it took me 32 years to figure that out. Isn't that amazing? So one of the things you'll come to understand is we don't necessarily get brighter as we stay sober. Okay? My dad said, I want you to be somebody. He told my brother, I want you to be somebody. See, when you don't have a lot of things, and my parents believed that the key to success was education, and they're going to give their kids education, they're going to give us goals. My dad said, be somebody, be somebody, be somebody. And I know he meant well, I know he loved me, but here's what I thought I heard. You are nobody. You have to figure out how to be somebody. Now, he didn't say that. That's what I heard. I had a sense of nobody from my earliest recollection. I don't know who Frank is. Frank is incomplete and not whole. I know that. But what he is, who he is, I have no idea. But I know that his search is to be somebody. I don't know why that happened, but it showed up in that inventory. Another thing showed up in that inventory, a guilt. From the earliest recollections I have guilt. I'm 6 years old, I shouldn't have guilt. I know guilt at 6 years old. I remember one day it showed up in my inventory. It was funny, but it was important enough to be there. My dad tells me I'm supposed to be a lawyer, and I build a tent in the backyard with a girl next door about a week later, and we got some old blankets, and we put them over a clothesline, and we got in that tent, and that day, and that afternoon, I knew what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I wanted to be a gynecologist, Pam. Really? From that day on, until I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and then for some time thereafter, Frank was obsessed with money and sex. Now, I thought that was bad, but about 15 years ago, if I was really smart, I would have realized that an obsession for sex and money would have put me on a pretty good chance to be a TV preacher. I don't know where I got this idea of guilt and why it was always related to sex as a kid. I remember that I learned about God. Father, I don't want to offend you, but I learned about God from ladies that walked into a classroom of little boys and little girls, and they were dressed in black and white, these ladies. And I remember a lady said, I'm going to teach you about God, and I'm going to teach you about sin. And I was 6 or 7 or 8 years old. And she said, there are two kinds of sin. There's a kind of sin we call it venial sin. And if you do those things and you die, you have offended God and you have to be punished, and you go to a place called purgatory. And then in purgatory, you burn. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm 6 years old and I don't like that concept. And apparently that lady in black and white saw the fear in my eyes, and she, and probably the other kids too, and she said, oh, but it's not so bad. If you just do those things and die, when you go to purgatory, you can get out of there in 3 or 4,000 years. When you're 8, 3 or 4,000 years seems like a long time. And it was like she unraveled a scroll, and on that scroll are hundreds of things. If you tell a lie, if you disobey your parents, all these things, and I'm 7, 8 years old. I look at those things and I know I offend God. God's mad at me. God's mad at me. I have offended him and I'm going to be punished. That's not a bad start. A couple of years later, she's decided to teach us about another kind of a sin. It's called mortal sin. There's less mortal sins, thank God. It's like a scroll, but there's not as many things on there. But I'm about 9 years old in time. She's telling me about mortal sin. And if you do those things and you die, you're done, baby. I mean, it's over. And I look at that list. I'm 9 years old and it looks, your neighbor's wife. I'm thinking, God, I want to do that. I mean, even when I'm 9, I'm thinking about doing it. I'm not even married and I'm coveting my neighbor's wife. Now, if she would have just left it alone at that, I probably would have been okay. But in the sixth grade, this lady in black and white walked into that classroom and asked the girls to leave. And I thought, here it comes. And when the girls left, she looked at everybody, but I was certain she was staring at me. And she said, boys, God sees in the dark. Oh, shit. And I thought to myself, yeah, but he can't see under the covers. I'm 36 years old and I'm writing about that stuff. And yet, they did not cause this. I'm not an alcoholic because of some lady in black and white. I don't know if any of those things ever were said that way. I just heard it that way. And I'm not here to tell you that that's why I'm this and that. AA has taught me one thing. I don't have any time to try to figure out how I got here. I got enough trouble figuring out where I'm going from here. See, because I may die while I'm trying to figure out how my alcoholism was caused. I don't know. It's not important. The point is, what am I going to do with the knowledge that there is hope for people like me? And am I going to take any action? So that's really what happened. But I drank. I'll give you a drinking story. It's no big deal. I drank. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a shaker. You ever see shakers? Shakers, they're kind of sad. But I was too smart to be a shaker. How could you be a shaker? And I made more money when I was 27 years old than the President of the United States. How do you do that? How do you do that? How could somebody who's as bright as me, who's as talented as me, who works as hard as me, end up a shaker? It's impossible. It can't happen, Joe. It can't happen to you, I'm sure. And it couldn't happen to me. But Joe, the funny thing about it is, it did. And I never intended that to happen. And it's funny about this thing called alcoholism. It has nothing to do with what we intend. It just happened. And I learned a secret, Joe. I learned how to sit in boardrooms and talk about million-dollar cases with people and shake. And I tell you what you do if you ever have to learn how to do it. If you want to get rid of the shakes, you drink. Because if you can get a couple of vodka martinis down, you will suddenly realize that the tremors will stop. Now, you'll intellectually realize that the drink is causing the shakes, but the drinks also make the shakes go away. And once you enter that world of uncontrollable drinking, there's really no room for argument about powerlessness or unmanageability. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any of that. But I remember one day I drank from the time I got out of law school until I was 34 years of age. And near the end of my drinking, which I didn't intend it to be the end of my drinking, I lived a double life. I, like Ernie, I never got arrested, never went to a treatment center, never got divorced, never lost a job. I was the head of the firm. How am I going to lose a job? The firm's named after me. I mean, I don't fire myself. I'm not that crazy. Yeah. One day I had to go to court on Thursday, and it's about $6 million. And if I'm successful, I get two of those million. Now, that's not a bad morning. And I say to myself, Frank, tomorrow's an important day. Maybe you shouldn't drink tonight. And I said to myself, that's right. I shouldn't, but I have to go to the country club. Well, Frank, you're a smart guy. You can figure this out. Yeah, I figured it out. I thought to myself, I'll go to the country club. I'll have a couple of drinks, and there'll be no problem. Tomorrow I'll go into court, and I will get that money. But you're going to drink. No, I'm not going to drink. I'm going to drink something I don't like. Well, what don't you like, Frank? Well, wait a minute. Let me think about that. I decided to drink a ladies' drink. Something that nobody would like to drink. And I came up on green cream de mint. Think about that. How much green cream de mint can you drink? Now, what do you argue? I mean, really? Safe drink. You go, you sashay up to the bar at the country club, and they say, Mr. Miles, what would you have? I'll have a green cream de mint on the rocks, please. How much green cream de mint can you drink? Let me tell you how much green cream de mint I could drink. The next morning, I got up, and my teeth were green, my tongue was green, and everything that exited my body was green. And I can't go to court. I never intended that to happen. That's a nothing. That's a throwaway story. I'm not going to do a fist up here. I can tell you stories that would shame me and possibly shame you just in the hearing of it. And I'm not going to do that because I have a responsibility standing behind this microphone. But I can tell you that it wasn't fun and joy. And when I was 31 years of age, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I called Alcoholics Anonymous because I was afraid that I was going to go further in this darkness of trying to live and not drink. See, I don't know what's wrong with me. By the time I'm 16 years of age, I have a sense that my problem is definition. I live in a world that other people talk about that I don't understand. They use words I don't understand. Here's a word. Hi, Frank. How are you? I don't know. I don't know. How am I? I don't even know who the hell I am. But I'm suited up. And I present myself as whatever you want me to be, and whatever that is, I will suit up for that, because I desperately need you to approve of me. See, when you don't have your own approval, you have to have the approval of others. In some crazy way, if I can get enough people to approve of me, then somehow, in a boomerang effect, I will approve of me, and I never could get my own approval. Because I never could get enough approval, because that's another one of those words, enough. What does enough mean? People say, have you had enough? Enough what? I've never had enough power, enough money, enough prestige, enough love, enough sex. What's enough? I don't know what enough is. What I am is a conglomeration of things that were best described by newcomers to me. One day I walked into the beginners meeting of the Lamont Oaks group of alcoholics. We have a little intimate group. You ought to come and visit us. We meet on Monday night. We're right outside the city of Chicago. And I suggest you come early. Because we only have 500 chairs. And they all get filled up. And sometimes we can borrow another 100. But that's all we can get. So we can only get 600 people at our regular scheduled meeting. We have a beginners meeting that is always full. And there's 200 chairs in that room. And they're full every week. People drive 100 miles to come in that beginner's meeting. And the only difference between that beginner's meeting and other beginner's meetings is we tell them the absolute truth. And the truth is that this is not a self-help program. This is a God-help program. We don't apologize for God, and we don't keep Him a secret from you. We don't stress the fellowship. We stress the program of recovery. Kind of an interesting thing, and we tell you. And you know why can we do that? Because a lot of us didn't get it, and a lot of us are dead, and a lot of us are drunk. If I tell you what's in that book, I take no risk whatsoever. I take no risk whatsoever. None. None. If I don't tell you the truth, I cheat you. And I don't want you to be cheated. You know why? Because Ernie said it. We have to keep this thing alive. If the people ahead of us had allowed it to be diluted by the time we got here, we would be not here. And Pam, when you showed up, there'd be nobody to tell you that this thing worked. It's a very important thing we have here. See, people die of this. Not their heart stops. You know the terrible thing, Joe, about alcoholism? It won't kill you. Your heart won't stop. That might be a long way down the line. What it does is it kills the quality of your life, so you don't care if you live or die. And the bad part of alcoholism is, after it kills the quality of your life, it may take 40 years to kill your heart. And the curse of alcoholics like me is that I may have to live with it. So when people say, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to die, I think when I'm new, I say, yeah, big deal. If life has no value, what do I care if I live or die? Isn't that an interesting kind of a thing? I don't know. I called Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, and I hung up the phone when I got an answer. And I took an inventory that day. I remember thinking to myself, good for you, Frank. You called Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I did? I called a number, and I got a recorded message. I live out in the suburbs. I got a recorded message, and the message was, good morning, this is, and I hung up. And I took an inventory. I don't know if you ever took an inventory, Joe, but I'll tell you how my inventory starts. I'm too young to be an alcoholic. I'm different. I got trouble. I got pressures. I came from the wrong parents. I got the wrong wife. I shouldn't have been a lawyer. I shouldn't have been a gynecologist. No wonder I'm not happy. I'm too smart to be an alcoholic. I'm too strong to be an alcoholic. I'm in good health. I'm too bright to be an alcoholic. Look at all those, that wall with all those degrees. Alcoholics, we know what alcoholics are. They're skid row bombs. That's my inventory talking. Frank, you're not an alcoholic. What you got to do is you got to figure out how to drink. And I think to myself, that's a good idea. I think I will. And a year later, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a live woman and I hung up the phone. Because I remembered having a good feeling the first time, and I like to have that feeling again. And I took another inventory. By this time, I was more successful than my dad ever thought possible. Ernie said it. We are overachievers. You tell us, you put a handicap in our way. Has it to do with commerce or industry or dollars or avocations or vocations, and we will outwork and outthink anybody else. You know, I knew how to beat those lawyers. I just stayed up all night and studied and read the cases and prepared what I was going to say. And they played golf.
You have reached the end of side one. Please turn to side two for the continuation of this program. Side two, audio portion will be...
No way. And here I am, I'm a young man, and I'm in my 30s, and I have more success than I ever dreamed possible, and I'm afraid to live because I know that I don't even care if I die. I remember when my third daughter was born, a little baby in my arms. Imagine, you know how beautiful it is to have a baby? There's a lady there with a little baby in her arms, and I'm holding this baby, and I'm thinking, I don't care if I'm alive or dead. How can you feel that way when you're holding a little baby in your hand? You can feel that way when the disease that you're suffering has taken from you all dignity. You see, when I walked into that beginner's meeting that day that I was telling you about, I asked the people in the beginner's meeting to do something for me. I asked them if they would answer a question. The simple question is this. What is an alcoholic? If you tell me and I tell you our understanding of what an alcoholic is, we will be on the same page, Joe. And from there, we might be able to determine whether or not, first of all, we ought to be here. Wouldn't it be nice if this whole thing was a misunderstanding and we could leave? I mean, Joe, I don't want to question your enthusiasm, but I had none when I was new. I mean, when they said, well, Frank, you have to go to meetings. I didn't think to myself, oh, I can't wait. I'm thinking, how many? Six? Eight? No. Just, you have to go to meetings until you want to go to meetings. And then you don't have to go to meetings anymore. You just go to meetings because you want to go to meetings. But once you stop wanting to go to meetings, you have to go to meetings. I'm thinking, hey, this is hocus pocus. You're talking about the rest of my life. And when I'm new, that's not an exciting adventure. So I walk into that room and I said, what's an alcoholic? Let's talk together, all of us. And there's maybe 80 newcomers then. This is a lot of years ago. And nobody answered. So what I said to them, and I don't know why this happened, I just said, well, let's do this. In the laboratory of our mind, let's make an alcoholic, just so we have some idea what the hell we're talking about here in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I handed them, or I held in front of them, an invisible test tube. And I asked them, from their experience, they're brand new, Pam, like you, how long you sober, Pam? 31 days. Joe? 50 days. And who's counting, right, Joe? So I asked them to fill this test tube with the ingredients that they thought, from their perception, were necessary to constitute the making of an alcoholic. And here's what they did. After some hesitancy and quiet, the first person that raised her hand was a little girl who was 16 years of age, and she said, put in fear. And a guy who was in his late 60s and new to Alcoholics Anonymous said, put in depression. And then the class, which we call it, or the group, came afire. Put in anxiety. Put in guilt. Put in remorse. Put in shame. Put in perfectionism. Put in ego. Put in loneliness. And the hands were going up as fast as I could point. Put in inferiority, someone said over here, and someone said, put in superiority. Now I'm thinking, my God. And they kept on going, and they filled it. There was a lot of, Father, there was a lot of guilt put in. There must have been five that raised their hand on guilt. There was just a lot of Catholics that night. And you know what they didn't put in, Pam? And I've repeated this test tube story to hundreds of thousands of people all over North America. And do you know what invariably is not put in the test tube by the newcomer in the making of an alcoholic? What do you think they forgot to put in, Pam? Joe? Do you know? Alcohol. They didn't put in alcohol. And you know why, Joe? Because they knew that this is not about alcohol. They knew before they ever read the book that alcohol is but a symptom of the problem. And they filled that test tube. And when they filled that test tube, they made me. Those guilts and those unfounded shames that were not imposed on me. It's like I did this to me. I don't know. All I know is I felt the way that test tube looked. And we conducted that experiment a little further. What we did in the laboratories of our minds as newcomers is we put some alcohol in me, that test tube. Do you know what just enough alcohol does to fear, Joe? What do you think? It what? It disappears. We call it diluting. I realized at that moment that when I drank to feel better. And that just enough alcohol put into Frank Milo's takes the fear away. It creates such change that my anxiety changes. Even my sense of guilt and shame changed when I drink just enough alcohol. Now, if you're an alcoholic of my type, and I hope that you're not, what you're going to find is that if you continue to use alcohol to affect that change, that one day, without any warning, it will stop working. And the dastardly thing about that is you won't know the day it happened. It just will happen and you won't know. And what you'll do, if you're like me, when that happens, is when it doesn't work, you decide to drink more. And more, and more, and more, and more. Why, Joe? To get nuts, to ruin your family, to punch your wife, to commit adultery, to lose your job, to puke on the table, to degrade yourself? Nope. If you're like me, Joe, you'll do it to live. You'll drink more simply to live. Now, what happens with people like me, apparently, is that once I do that, and once it stops working, instead of making the things in the test tube clear, or as you said, Joe, go away, here's what alcohol does to people like me. If I keep drinking and it stops working, and I keep drinking after it stops, I learn a new meaning of the word guilt. Because it now not only does it dilute what's in me, it intensifies what's in me. You think I know lonely before? You should have been with me in my last phase of drinking. My last phase of drinking gave me insights into new meanings of shame and guilt and dirty. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous as dirty as you could ever imagine. And so do a lot of people like me. We walk in here dirty. And it's not something we talk about when we get our hugs. But it's something that bears inside people like me. And unless I do something about it, it's going to get me. And that's one of the most wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous, Joe. Alcoholics Anonymous does for people like me what alcohol used to do. If I take you and me, Joe, and we're like the test tube, and I take the alcohol out of the test tube, I'm still going to be left with everything that's in the test tube. You know that? Alcoholics Anonymous puts something in that works just like alcohol. They're called steps. You take the steps dilute fear. The steps dilute anxiety. The steps dilute depression. Guilt leaves with the taking of the steps. Loneliness is absent. Ego is not an obsession with the taking. Isn't that a strange story? And I didn't believe that for a long time, even after I came into Anonymous. It's a great call, and I recommend it as a form of 12-step call to anybody who says, I don't know how to make a 12-step. Make it like George made it on me. On November 3rd, 1971, I got up in the morning and I called Alcoholics Anonymous for the third and last time, and I'll never call again. Because I don't think I'll ever be able to get enough ego deflation to ever reach. And I got a woman, and I didn't hang up. And that lady asked me my name and my age and what I did for a living. And I didn't want to tell her any of those things because it was none of her business. But she was persistent, and she got those things out of me. And she said, I gave her that information. She said, I will have somebody call you after 6 o'clock tonight. And I said, lady, I'm not going to need you. It's 9 o'clock in the morning, Joe. By 9 o'clock in the morning, I want help. By 10 o'clock, I'll take an inventory. I've done that 1,000 times. I know all about inventories. And I said, lady, it's not going to work. I don't know if you know about alcoholism, lady, but the problem is I want now to talk to someone. And if you delay me, I'm going to just dismiss you. I know how my mind works, because I'll take a drink. I'll say, it's going to be different this time, Frank. This time you'll drink different. You'll change who you are, peace and happiness, and go with your girlfriend or... You have to do something. I have things going on in my intent to violate that woman or to those three little kids that were raised in my home. Never was my intent. I can't do that, Joe. I'm too decent of a human being, and I could not do the things I did. But I did them. And I did them with every intention of acting opposite. Alcohol controlled how I live, Joe. It controlled how I lived. And the lady said, if you're that serious about your problem, there's a place in Chicago you can go, and there's alcoholics there. And Joe, I got up that morning and I put on the most expensive blue silk imported suit you ever saw. I had a suntan. I just come back from Puerto Rico or someplace. I got all the gold I had on. I had diamond rings. I got in my new Cadillac. I drove out of a big circular drive that was in front of this big house that I lived on top of this hill that everybody could see where I live, because that's what I do to make you stay away from me. Because I learned very simple in life. You want to be somebody, make them believe you got more than they have and they will think you're somebody. So you adorn yourself with this stuff, hoping that maybe by being superior you could feel even. Never worked. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous like that. And I drove into the city and I got in front of this goofy storefront building, and that was Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just a club room in Skid Row. And I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing here? And I'm ashamed that I'm here. And I walked in there and a young man with a white shirt and a tie walked in and he looked at me and said, do you need help? I thought to myself, you got to be kidding. Didn't you see me pull up? Don't you see how I'm dressed? I didn't realize it until a long time after. You see, you can fool the people at the country club with your Mercedes-Benz and your Rolex watches and your trips to Paris. And you can even fool them with the kind of clothes you have or the girl you have on the side. And they'll bite at that. But alcoholics don't see that. What alcoholics look is in your eyes. And you cannot cover up your dilemma, your fear, your guilt, your bewilderness, and your desperation in your eyes. I don't care how much gold or how much money, it's there, and he saw it. And I stayed with that young man for about 6 hours, and I told him stuff that I never thought I'd tell another human being. And I cried. I cried like a baby. I'm talking to the stranger. Tears are rolling down my eyes. I don't want to live like this. I'm like a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. I've been brought up to be a good, decent guy, and I'm a pervert, for Christ's sake, is the kind of talk I had. And I apologize for saying that. But the desperation. Then he said to me, hey, Frank, it's getting late. Let's go to a meeting. We'll have something to eat and we'll go to a meeting. I said, are you kidding me? I'm thinking to myself, I don't want to go to a meeting. What do I want to be in a meeting for? I've had all the AA one person could stand in a day. And I lied to him. The very first time someone asked me to do something in AA, I lied. I said, I have to be home for dinner. I got to get home for dinner. I hadn't, Pam, been home for dinner for 6 years. Nobody goes home for dinner. After the office, I go out. I have things to do. I have people to meet. I have rendezvous to schedule. Not to go home. I go home when the kids are in bed. I go home when those three little girls who are 4 and 6 and 8 or whatever the ages were, and I don't remember how sad it is. I don't remember, and I still don't. I don't want to have them see me like this. It's better they see me on the weekend, if at all. I lied to him. He said, okay, here's my phone number. Call me if you ever want to go to a meeting. I got home. I got halfway home. I called my wife. I said, Lee, you won't believe what I've done for us or for you. I went to AA. And she said, we're having chicken. It'll be on the table at 6. And she hung up the phone because she didn't care if I came home or not. And she had not cared for years. And I walked into the house, that big house on top of that hill with that big circular drive, and there was a woman who didn't care and 3 kids with computer eyes. Computer eyes are okay maybe with adults, but do you ever see computer eyes in a child? What kind of day did daddy have? What kind of day did daddy have? You know why little kids like that have to have computer eyes? Because my kids have to determine what kind of monster is coming in. You see, I can walk in and be Mr. Wonderful. I just won a big case and my girlfriend told me she can get off for the weekend, or we're going to do stuff and my life isn't wonderful. And I can walk in and say to my children, you are wonderful. You are my little girls. God sent you to me. Come give daddy a hug. Or I could lose or feel bad or guilty or wrong or dirty. And then I might just walk past them with no warning and knock them off the chair because they left a shoe in the middle of the living room. What kind of day did daddy have? I can't do that. That can't happen. It can't happen to you, Joe, and it can't happen to you, Pam, and it couldn't happen to me, and it happened. And it had something to do with how I was drinking. It had something to do with uncontrollable, impossible, unmanageable powerlessness. 2 minutes after I walked in, the phone rang and I jumped like a cat. Because I thought to myself, my God, I know who that is. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's what I heard. Hello, Frank. My name is George. I got your name from central office. I understand you got a problem with booze. I said, yes, George, I have a problem. But I went to an AA club. I'd like to come over and talk to you about it. I thought to myself, to my house? How could I bring an alcoholic to my house? Think about it. I live in this big house on top of a hill. Everybody can see. I don't know how you show up. I don't know if some old Volkswagen bus with P-signs. I have no idea. I can't inflict this on my kids. Who are they, Daddy? Well, they're drunks. No. I can't do this. I mean, I look at my house. We just had interior decorating. We got beautiful new carpeting. It's white. I'm going to have alcoholics come here. This is going in my mind like that. I don't even know how it's happening. And I lie to him. Here it is, my second request of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to come over and talk to you about it, he says. And I say, no, I can't do it, George. Because, you see, I have to go to a PTA meeting. I never went to a PTA meeting in my life. That is so wonderful. I have a special, Joe, I have a special unique talent and gift that really made it very easy for me to be a very successful lawyer. And it's just inherent in who I am. I don't even practice it. It's just a gift. The gift is simply this. If you put me in a corner or put pressure on me, I can lie with no thought process. I mean, I just lie. And he said he wanted to come over, and I said, no, I'm going to a PTA meeting. I had never gone to a PTA meeting. I never known a human being that went to a PTA meeting. And I didn't have to think about it. It just came to me. It's just wonderful. And he said, what time is that meeting over? And I don't know. What's the difference? I don't have to think about it. My gifts. I'm in the zone now, like Michael Jordan said. Sometimes I'm just in the zone. It just happens. Well, that's how it is for me when I lie. And he says, and I said, 9:30. I'll be there at 9:45. No problem. I'm in the zone. I'm floating, Joe. Normally, George, that would be all right. But tonight, after a regularly scheduled PTA meeting, we have a board of directors meeting, and I'm on the board. What time is that meeting over? 10:30. I'll be there at 10:45. I said, George, you're not going to believe this. See, I'm in a zone. I mean, I'm really going now. It's Scottie Pippen and me. I said, George, you're not going to believe this, but after the board of directors meeting, we have a finance committee meeting, and I'm chairman of the finance meeting. Might as well be chairman. What the hell? Chairman of the finance committee meeting. We're raising money for the PTA. What time is that meeting over? I said, midnight. Figuring, he's an alcoholic. Got to be stiff by midnight. I'll be there at 12:15. I said, George, now this is the same guy who, just a few hours, is crying crocodile tears to some young kid in a club on Skid Row. The big man crying tears is now playing mind games with this guy named George. And I said, George, listen, this isn't going to work. Why don't you leave your name and number and I'll get back to you? And you hear that God speaks through the membership. You'll hear that, Joe. Pam, you'll hear that. God talks through the members, people will say. On November 3rd, 1971, God spoke through George, and God had a dirty mouth. Because when I told George to leave his name and number, he started to scream and swear and call me. George is a professional swearer. George, he has phrasing and timing and he went crazy. And he kept calling me goof over the phone. That's a great 12-step call. And I'd love to tell you some of the things he said, but I can't violate this trust. Let me tell you this. Up until that time, George had never met a member of my family, but he seemed to know my mother. And he went nuts. He said, "Listen, you goof, do you think I've got nothing better to do than be on the phone with a lion, blah, 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 like you? You disgust me," he said. Put that on your note, how to make a good 12-step call. "You disgust me," he said. "You think I've got nothing better to do than waste my time like this? Goof!" Now, had I known you had a New York office, I would have reported him. But I didn't know that. He said, "Listen, goof, if it's not too inconvenient, would you answer three questions and then I'm going to hang up?" And I thought, anything to get rid of him. The same guy who was crying and who was destined and going to change and going to join AA and make life different. The same guy. Isn't it funny how this thing works with people as sick as me? He said, what do you do for a living? Are you somebody important? I said, "Yeah, I'm somebody important." He said, "Are you famous?" I said, "Sure, I'm famous." He said, "Well, are you a lawyer?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, famous, important lawyer, I'm a lawyer. And when they called me and asked me to make this call, they gave me your name. And then they gave me your address. And I realized that I have practiced law for 17 years, 5 miles away from where you live, and I've never heard of you." And, I said, "What time can you come?" And he said, "I'm not coming because you're not worth it." And then he said, "If you want to talk to me, you come to my house." And he gave me the address. And it was in Beverly Hills in Chicago. And Beverly Hills in Chicago is just like Beverly Hills in Los Angeles. It's where they live. And I thought to myself, good fortune, I'm going to get in the good branch. And I drove to that house and I parked my car and I walked up and I knocked on the door and a little ugly guy answered after the door. He said, "Frank." I said, "Yep." He said, "Stay right there." He didn't let me in. I stood on the porch. Seemed like 5,000 years in purgatory, might have been 2 minutes. He came out and took me to my first meeting about a year later. We were having coffee one day. He said, "Frank, do you remember the day you came to my house?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you remember I had you stand on the porch?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Did you ever wonder why I did that?" I said, "No, George, why did you do that?" He said, "Because we just got new carpeting." I went to the Alcoholics Anonymous and I heard the music. And I hope and pray that you've heard the music at this conference. I tell you this in closing. This thing works. And the only obstacle in your way is your judgment. Surrender it to another human being. And in that process, you will come to understand that this program works very simply because something special happens when one alcoholic speaks to another. And what they speak about is very simple. I can't, you can't, but he can. God could and would if he were sought. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, it is my experience, are two separate and distinct ideas. And sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous, all we present to people like you is the fellowship. It's meetings and hugs and kisses and conventions and picnics and movies and more hugs. That's wonderful. It's supportive. It gives you hope. It creates a pressure, an atmosphere that's conducive, maybe, to your moving on. But I would ask you just to consider for a minute the fellowship as if it were a hospital, and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as if it were the operation. Go to the hospital and get all the love and care and sterile environment and good support and good constructive information, and don't get the operation. You will die in the midst of that sterile, warm, loving environment. Alcoholics of my type have to both go to the hospital and get the operation. Don't cheat yourself. You and I can beat the odds. Now you might say, Frank, you might just want to jump up and scream, I didn't come here to save my soul. I came here to save my ass. If that is what you'd like to say, my response is simply this. I felt that way too, but I stayed around long enough to find out that my ass and soul are connected. Thank you.